Okay, this is Jonathan Bernstein conducting an oral history interview with Mr. James Moran on the 27th of February, 2002, at approximately 2 o'clock Central Standard Time, 3 o'clock Eastern Standard. Now, Mr. Moran, can you, I guess, you start off by giving us a brief biographical sketch of yourself, growing up, etc.?
I was born in Worcester, Massachusetts, and grew up in the area. In fact, the first time I ever really left home, as it were, when I went into the Army in 1968. I was in my junior year at the University of Connecticut and had a modest disagreement, you might call it, with the dean of students over my academic standing. I was an English major, and it was very difficult reconciling my conservative upbringing with what was happening on college campuses in 1968. Initially, I'd gone to try to join the Marine Corps to get into their pilot program. I wanted to be a fighter pilot ever since I was a little kid. But just before I was sworn into the Marine Corps, they changed their requirement to a minimum educational requirement of a bachelor's degree. And even though I had an assigned flight class at Pensacola, they decided they were going to send me to Quantico, Virginia, to PLC. And when I inquired as to what PLC was, they said, "That's platoon leader's class." I said, "That sounds an awful lot like infantry second lieutenant."
Yes.
And thanks, but no thanks. So I volunteered for the draft and was drafted into the Army. Whereupon I thought they'd make me a clerk or something of that nature because I had 3 years of college, but in the Army's infinite wisdom, they made me an infantryman. And one day, just on a whim, I took a day off to take an examination for warrant officer candidate school, and I had absolutely no clue what a warrant officer was, other than the fact that it was an opportunity to take a day off. I had orders for Vietnam, and those were canceled. And I was sent to Fort Walters, Texas, for flight training.
Excellent.
And that's how I got into that mess.
Okay. Now, were pretty much all warrant officer candidates going to Walters for flight training at that point?
During that period of time, yes. And they came from various various sources. There were some kids who, if I recall correctly, and we were kids, 19, 20, 21 years old, who enlisted directly into the Army for the Warrant Officer Candidate Program. And as I recall, they took their basic training at Fort Polk, Louisiana, and then were sent directly to Fort Walters. There are others who took a more circuitous route. We had guys in our class who already had tours as enlisted men in Vietnam in various capacity. Some were infantrymen, some were helicopter crewmen. Some guys like myself kind of meandered into it by a more circuitous route. So, came from various sources, at least among the warrant officers, the warrant officer candidates.
Excellent. Now, how was the training at Walters? Basic helicopter?
The syllabus changed over time. When I went through, in classes prior to me, we went directly into the warrant officer candidate companies. There were 4 weeks of absolute hell. Warrant officer, real live warrant officers, chased us around, made life fairly miserable for us for about a month. We took academic classes, military and officer development classes. Then we went into the flight program, which lasted approximately 12 weeks of primary training. Subsequent to the time I went in, the candidates would go into what we called the snowbird companies before they came into the warrant officer candidate companies, and they'd spend 4 weeks in the snowbird companies getting what we got, for 4 weeks before they came right in. And then they went right into flight training.
Okay. Did you have any flight experience before entering the Army?
Flight experience?
Right.
Other than having an interest and aircraft, and in particular military aircraft. No, in fact, I didn't even know how a helicopter operated. I had absolutely no clue until I got to Fort Walters.
Okay. Now, the warrant officer instructors there, were a large percentage of them Vietnam veterans, or not?
As far as I knew, all of the military instructors were Vietnam vets.
Okay.
There were some civilian instructors. I never had contact with civilian instructors. Later on, when I went back to Walters as a TAC officer in the Warrant Officer Candidate Companies, Southern Airways, a civilian contractor, was doing most of the initial training.
Okay. All right. I got a bit of a cold. Getting into flight training, what types of helicopters were you flying? What were the academics like?
Academics took up half a day.
Okay.
During primary helicopter training, it was basic navigation, basic aerodynamics, this is what makes a helicopter work,
okay.
types of things. Safety, heavy emphasis on emergency procedures.
Okay. Auto rotation, et cetera?
It just ran the gamut. I recall I flew in the TH-55A,
mm-hmm.
Which was a Hughes four-cylinder Lycoming engine. Not very heavy,
mm-hmm.
and pretty frail looking.
Yeah, tiny little thing.
As I recall, one of the most feared situations you could get into in a TH-55 was what they called ground resonance,
mm-hmm.
and I never experienced it. But essentially, the aircraft just vibrated itself into a scrap heap.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. So I don't recall what caused the situation,
mm-hmm.
but I remember that it was like you don't want to experience this.
Hmm. How would you counteract that?
I don't recall at the moment.
Okay.
I don't think there was any way of recovering once you got into it, other than dumb luck.
Huh. Okay. Oh.
Yeah. Now some of the bigger guys, the average, we smaller fellows, 5'9", 5'10", and under, flew the TH-55s, but we had some big galoots who flew the Hiller OH-12 Raven,
mm-hmm.
and the Bell TH-13 Sioux.
Okay.
At least initially. When I came back from Vietnam, the warrant officer candidate class that I had was taking its primary training on OH-58 Kiowas.
Really?
Yep.
Okay.
I don't know if they were the first class to do it. That was in, I want to say, March of 1970, March or April of 1971.
Okay.
And at the time, I recall, the Army had pretty much gotten rid of all the Ravens and Sioux's,
mm-hmm.
at least for primary training, and they were sending a lot of TH-55s to Davis-Monthan Air Force Base for cocooning.
Mm-hmm.
So, I remember flying a couple of those ferry flights.
Uh-huh.
Most uncomfortable flight I've ever had in my life.
Really?
Yeah. Well, take it from Mineral Wells, Texas to Phoenix, Arizona was quite a long trip for
it. Quite the hike.
Yeah, for a TH-55.
Yeah. How many times did you stop on the way?
Oh, I lost count. I know it was a 2-day trip.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Oh, I can imagine. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So how long was the training at Walters, and then I assume you went on to Rucker after that?
Yeah, Walters initially was 16 weeks, and I believe Rucker was the same.
Okay.
The same.
And Rucker, you were transitioning into Huey's?
Well, Rucker was the most interesting training, and we were, by the time we got there, we had a fair amount of flight time under our belt. Initially, we were put in TH-13s for instrument training, and that was a lot of fun, as I recall. Hard work, but a lot of fun. That was augmented with a number of hours in link trainers, which they don't, you know, they were rather primitive simulators.
Yes. They didn't actually have more modern simulators at that point?
No, we were using the links.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah, using link trainers. And that, it was more difficult flying that thing. We called them the blue canoes because they were painted blue.
Yeah.
That was more difficult than actually flying.
Really?
Yeah. And the H-13 was very stable and forgiving as far as an instrument platform went. But we'd do max performance takeoffs from the ground totally blind.
Wow.
Under the hood, fly for an hour to an hour and a half, total instrument flight rules. Never saw the outside of the aircraft. Would take ground controlled approaches to minimums, and then the instructor pilot would take over, or we'd be allowed to look up and kick the hood back and make a visual approach the remainder of the way.
Wow.
Sometimes they'd do it just to scare us if we were, you know, really screwing up and off in the woods somewhere.
Be a little hairy.
Yeah. So we went through that, and then it was transition into the Hueys.
Okay.
Which was, and I think that was for all of us in flight school at the time, that was the rite of passage.
Mm-hmm.
Once you got into the Hueys, you pretty much knew you were going to make it.
Okay.
You know, unless you did something of a disciplinary nature that got you washed out.
But, mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, that was a big thrill one. You know, when you get out of that, you know, those little bubbles and you're really sitting inside something that was substantial.
Uh-huh.
And we were all a little intimidated by it, but a little amazed by it when the first time the instructor pilot let you have the controls to pick it up to a hover and you didn't kill yourself. You know, it's kind of like, hey, I can do this.
What was it like learning to hover?
Oh, God. The first time, and hopefully there's... I'm sure there are some films available of it.
Uh-huh.
But the instructor would... The first thing he'd do is he'd take it up to a hover somewhere on a stage field where there's plenty of room,
mm-hmm.
and he'd let you have the pedals. And he'd just say, keep it pointed at that tree.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, we'd overcorrect, you know, start moving a little bit. The next thing you knew, the helicopter was just yawing back and forth, you know, 90 degrees in either direction. Once you mastered, or sort of mastered that, he'd just give you the stick,
mm-hmm.
the cyclic control, and tell you to, you know, keep it over this spot. Of course, we couldn't do that.
Okay.
And then he'd give you the collective and say, okay, maintain this altitude, and we, you know, couldn't do that. And then it progressed to you have all three controls, and you couldn't keep it in the county.
Mm-hmm.
And as days went by, it was amazing. You know, now you could keep it, you know, not only in the county but in the town, and then you could keep it within the confines of the stage field, and then you could keep it within a, you know, a 12x12 box, and before you knew it, you know, you could hover. It was just a if you had any kind of coordination at all,
mm-hmm.
you could handle it.
Excellent.
It was interesting.
Yeah, definitely not like fixed wing from what I've heard.
Oh, no, we used to look down on fixed wing pilots, you know. I mean, it's a, you know, an airplane, you know, unless it was, you know, controlled by a total incompetent, would pretty much fly itself,
uh-huh.
you know. But a helicopter, that was a beast of a different nature.
Mm-hmm.
Just hundreds and hundreds of parts flying in formation, you know, trying to rip one another apart.
Right. Okay. Now, once you graduated, did you immediately go to Cobra Transition School, or did you head for Vietnam first?
No, in my class, there were a number of us who were given the opportunity based upon, I don't know, some subjective criteria, who could go on to more advanced training.
Uh-huh.
If I recall, the choices were AMED, which was medevac school,
uh-huh.
Multi-engine, which at the time was Chinooks,
okay.
And Cobra transition. I went to Cobra transition immediately from flight school.
Mm-hmm. And that was at Fort Hunter?
That was at, right, Fort Hunter, Hunter Stewart in Savannah, Georgia.
Okay. When was the first time you saw Cobra?
I saw one when I was in flight school.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody had just, I think a transient had flown into the main heliport at Walters.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, you know, everybody wanted to see it.
Uh-huh.
It was like, that was the Cadillac of airplanes, and it was beyond our wildest dreams that we'd ever be able to, you know, fly one of those things. That was, you know, that was something that that John Wayne did, not mere mortals.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Definitely a sexy aircraft. All right, so I guess transition training to the Cobra. I guess describe that.
It was, you know, by that time we had, I think, somewhere around 200 hours of flight time in training under our belts, and Cobra transition was just learning the idiosyncrasies of the Cobra versus the Huey.
Mm.
In auto rotation, you didn't have that nice big flat belly to help decelerate you in a flare.
Okay.
A Cobra tended to want to, you know, keep on flying right into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they Cobras were like flying a brick when you lost power.
Huh.
The flight controls, you in a Huey, you kind of led your turns, as I recall. I could be wrong, but you led your turns with a cyclic. In a Cobra, you led your turn with pedal.
Okay.
And it just flew a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it was a little bit faster
than a
Huey. So approaches were a little different. You had a little more power.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to, just flying, it was a matter of just staying a little bit more ahead of the aircraft until it became second nature and you didn't have to think about it anymore. But as far as flying characteristics, same problems you encountered in a Huey. Most of the components were from a Huey anyway, the drivetrain and all that.
Yeah. Now, when you're training on Hueys, were those Charlie models or Bravo models?
No. We had a mixture. We had A models, some B models, and some D models.
Okay.
Advanced training at Hunter was split into two tracks. Once you went through Huey transition and you got into what was called tactical training, it split. Some students flew transport, if you will, Hueys, and others of us went the gunship track.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened to myself and some others. We flew old beat-up B models.
Uh-huh.
Had some gunnery training, learned how to fire the, you know, the minigun and fire rockets and the 40-millimeter grenade launcher.
Okay. So they were basically, you know, kitted out as gunships?
Yes, okay. They were.
All right. How easy was it to transition from the Huey to the Cobra?
It wasn't that difficult. It was just, I know one of the things that I recall I had a problem with was my approaches were too shallow.
Uh-huh.
You know, the approach angle was too shallow. And that got cured in Vietnam.
Okay.
So,
right.
It didn't make one of those nice, long, slow, you know, gradual approaches.
Came in hard and fast.
Well, you learned... I don't know, in training you kind of wanted, you know, you tried to finesse your control movements. Once you got to Vietnam and you really got comfortable in the aircraft, and it was the same with the Huey, you'd make gross control movements.
Huh.
You know, you didn't mind. You know, in a Huey you made nice, slow, standard turns.
Huh.
In Vietnam, slow, standard turns were a recipe for disaster.
Right.
You know, you bent it over and... I mean, I can remember watching Hueys just do big corkscrew approaches into LZs, probably at the lowest power settings possible, just pretty much controlled crashes until they got within 15, 20 feet of the ground.
Uh-huh.
I was always amazed that, you know, some of them didn't crash watching them. And the same with a Cobra. You didn't fly in straight lines. You didn't fly parallel to any terrain features. You didn't, you know, fly low level across a big open field or paddy area out in what we called Indian country. You changed course. You know, changed altitudes, and you didn't do it, you know, with any finesse at all.
Okay. Right. Now, I guess you get your orders for Vietnam. Well, actually, did you know at that point? I mean, I guess you had to have known you were headed to Vietnam.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, well, in kind of an ironic twist, the flight class that I graduated with at Fort Rucker, the only ones of us who got orders to Vietnam were the folks who went on to advanced training.
Really?
All of the other guys got assignments to Germany. I remember a few got Hawaii, some stateside assignments. They did not go immediately to Vietnam, but eventually they did.
Uh-huh.
For those of us who went on to advanced training, our orders were cut to Vietnam, and we were TDY to whatever transition school we were going to.
Okay. And what month was this?
When I went to Vietnam?
Yeah, well, graduation.
I graduated in November of 1969.
Okay.
Yeah. From flight school.
Right.
I went directly to Hunter Stewart, and I got out of there. Oh, boy. Middle of January, we had a two-week or 10-day Christmas hiatus where we just pretty much hung around and did nothing.
Okay.
Because we all had leave before we went to Vietnam.
Okay. And when did you arrive in country?
In country?
Uh-huh.
And on February, say, February 18th, 1970.
Okay. Now, at that point, did you know what unit you were going to? Or?
No. No, we flew in, at least the bunch I went in with, we flew out of Travis Air Force Base in California with a stop in Fairbanks, Alaska, and a stop in Japan, and then into Saigon is where we landed, at Tonsonut.
All right.
I don't recall the details, but I do remember we were sent to a replacement depot, if you will, and Long Bin.
Right, 90th replacement?
I don't remember the designation, but that sounds right.
Okay.
From there, once we were there, we were in processed and paperwork and all, and then we were farmed out to the various divisions, and I remember being delighted that I was assigned to the 1st Cav.
Uh-huh.
So we got our division assignments from Long Bin. Those of us who were assigned to the 1st Cav went to Binh Hoa.
Okay.
Which was division headquarters. And we were in process to there. Officers and enlisted went through a 2 or 3 day quote-unquote cab school.
Okay.
Now, I remember we had to rappel off a tower and shoot an M60 machine gun and just in-country and division orientation.
Huh.
And from there, we got our individual battalion assignments.
Okay. Now, at that point, were you aware of the different functions or the different types of missions that Cobras were flying?
Units? Yeah. So? At least in the 1st Cav, I was aware of what was going on.
Okay. I guess headed to the 20th Aerial Rocket Artillery, what were your impressions of that?
Initially, I was terribly disappointed.
Really?
Because every gunship driver in the world who was assigned to the 1st Cav wanted to fly with the Air Cav troops,
uh-huh.
first of the ninth.
Okay.
And so, you know, I was assigned to the 2nd of the 20th, and I knew they were the ARA battalion for the Cav. Knew nothing of their history.
Okay.
We were given a demonstration by two ARA Cobras at Benoit, just to show how they were used and all. I was sent up to, from Benoit, I was sent to battalion headquarters at Fouque Vent.
Okay.
Which was called Camp Gorvad at the time. And I remember, I don't recall how long I was there, but I went up with a couple of fellows that I was not too pleased with. I'd gone through flight school, and I didn't like them.
Uh-huh.
Let's put it that way. We'd, one of them was a gung-ho type who paraded around at Fort at Hunter Stewart in a green beret with all kinds of combat decorations. And he was, you know, a wannabe.
Uh-huh.
And I just wasn't too pleased with him. Another guy was okay, but, you know, wasn't, our personalities didn't fit.
Mm-hmm.
We clashed. And when I got to Camp Gorvad, I guess my attitude came out, because when assignments came out, I remember those guys got to stay at Fouque Vent.
Uh-huh.
Because they had demonstrated a military bearing and an attitude that was more becoming, you know.
Uh-huh.
an Army warrant officer. And I was sent to Charlie Battery, which was up towards the Cambodian border.
Okay.
And I guess that's where they sent bad boys. And I was, when I got there, it was like, what have I gotten myself into? And it turned out to be the greatest bunch of guys I've ever spent any time with in my life. Yeah.
That's great.
They just had a spirit, and the day I land, I went up, landed at Quan Loi. LZ Andy. It was just an airstrip carved out of an old rubber plantation with a perimeter around it, and out in the middle of nowhere. And when I landed, there were all kinds of smoke grenades going off, and I jumped off the helicopter, not knowing what to expect, and a captain ran out, took my duffel bag, told me to lose my cap, and escorted me to what they called their club, their officer's club, which was a bunker dug into the ground, buried in sandbags.
Okay.
That was it. And they had a party for me.
Really?
They were, well, I guess they hadn't gotten any new guys for quite a long time, and within the space of like 3 or 4 days, there were 3 or 4 new guys who came in, and of course all the pilots were happy as hell to see us, because that meant fresh meat and they could get a day off.
So
it didn't take long, to 2 or 3 days, and we were flying combat missions.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, were you... Were you flying front seat, rear seat at that point?
Front seat.
Front seat.
Yeah. My very first mission, I flew with my platoon commander, a fellow named Ray Mulcahy.
Mm-hmm.
He was a captain. And it was a four-ship formation, and we were going out on what was called a Hellfire mission.
Mm-hmm.
And that was going up against anti-aircraft weapons. And I was scared skinny. I went through the whole mission, and I didn't see a damn thing.
Really?
I didn't. I saw nothing.
You didn't take fire or anything?
I wouldn't have known if we did.
Really?
As I recall, we didn't. I expected to see these anti-aircraft emplacements. I had no idea what to look for. We came in from 4 different directions. They ripple-fired the entire load. We broke off and went back to base.
Really?
Yeah, it was like, and I just sat there going like, what happened? You know, and they said, congratulations, newbie, you just survived your first combat mission in Vietnam.
Like, wow.
What did we just do? You know, I had no idea, no clue.
Wow. I guess you can never really get used to it, but how long did it take you to, I guess, get used to flying combat missions? Knowing what was, I guess, being able to see what was going on, etc.
I was pretty fortunate because at that time, in early 1970, February, March, there really wasn't a lot going on.
Uh-huh.
So we kind of eased into it. And the 2nd or the 20th had a host of different missions.
Uh-huh.
Where you look at the 227th and the 229th, D Company of the 227th and 229th.
Right.
Their primary mission was to support their battalion lift elements.
Right.
First of the 9th, their Cobras went out on hunter-killer missions. Go out with a little bird and a red bird and look for bad guys. The 2nd of the 20th had a whole bunch of different missions. We would go out on what were called GAPs, ground assault plans. And basically our job was to provide pre-insertion artillery suppression, okay, of the area around landing zones.
Okay.
Right? And then the lift ships would come in. As the lift ships went in, their gunships would escort them in.
Okay.
We would break off and climb to altitude.
Uh-huh.
Once the lift was out, their gunships would take the lift ships out. Their job was done. We would stay overhead, make contact with the ground elements until they'd secured the LZ,
mm-hmm.
and we were released by the ground commander.
Okay.
Or, as it turned out, a number of times, they requested close air support.
Okay.
At which time we'd stay. That was one mission.
Really?
Yeah. The second mission and the primary mission of ARA was close air support for 1st Cav Division ground elements.
Okay.
And in that capacity, we were on 24-hour alert,
uh-huh.
Where D Company of the 227th or 229th or the 1st of the 9th would have the opportunity to be pre-briefed for a mission. 2nd of the 20th, we did not have any clue what we were going to do until we were airborne.
Okay.
A klaxon would go off. It was actually an air horn.
Mm-hmm.
And we had 2 minutes to get to our aircraft, fire up, and be airborne.
Really?
Within 2 minutes. At that point, we would contact our tactical operations center, and they would give us the mission.
Okay.
Tell us where we, you know. Typically, they'd give us the first thing they'd say is, it was either a gap, a fire mission, or a medevac escort.
Mm-hmm.
That was our third. And then they'd say, you know, your contact is whatever the call sign was. They'd give us a coded frequency, a direction, and a distance, and then they give us the coded location of the contact. And we would just take off in the direction that we were given and try to find where we were going on the map, decode the frequencies, and make contact with whomever we were supposed to make contact with.
Mm-hmm.
On a gap, it would be the lift ship flight leader, initially, and then it would be the ground commander once the lift had departed the LZ.
Okay.
On a fire mission, it would be whomever the ground commander was.
Okay.
That could be anything from a battalion commander down to a squad leader.
Hmm.
If a squad were in an ambush or needed support, we'd be scrambled to support them.
Okay.
And the third mission was the medevac mission, and that was medevac escort. And our job there was to get them in and get them out.
Now, how often would you stand alert?
With the 2nd of the 20th, we had we had a commitment for 4 sections every day,
okay.
8 aircraft.
Oh, all right.
And we always traveled in sections of 2.
Okay.
There'd be a hot section, a yellow section, a blue section, and a standby section. The hot section, when the klaxon went off, immediately scrambled and went out.
Mm-hmm.
And then everybody moved up one slot.
Okay.
When you came back from a mission, refueled, rearmed, you immediately, if you were the hot section, you immediately went back to the hot section, and everybody else dropped down a slot.
Oh, okay.
So, then the following day, you'd go from the hot section to the standby section.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go to the blue, yellow, and hot again. There was no regular scheduled time off.
Uh-huh.
When I first got there, we flew our ass off.
Really?
Because, you know, they had so many aircraft commanders and people scheduled for rotation in the next 3 or 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
I remember myself, Jimmy Neighbors, the other guys were George Tebbets. We, we were constantly flying because they needed to get the hours and experience under us. In fact, we got there, we started doing the transition and workup to aircraft commander in April.
Okay, so it's it's fairly quick.
It was fast.
Yeah,
it was fast. Jimmy Neighbors, I think, was the first of us to get his AC orders.
Okay.
George Tebbets, and then myself, and I got my AC orders in the early part of June. So I was there for 4 months.
Now, standard weapons load was always 4 19-round rocket pods, or did you vary it at all?
No, not standard. We had two different configurations.
Okay.
The heavy configuration was the 4 19-shot rocket pods.
Okay.
But we never carried 19. You couldn't get it off the ground with 19.
Right.
Not there.
Okay.
And not carry a fuel load that would take you anywhere.
Uh-huh.
So we would, I think sometimes, I think we normally carry maximum 16 or 17 per pod.
Okay.
Then we had some aircraft that were configured with two miniguns in the turret,
okay.
Some with a minigun and a 40-millimeter grenade launcher. We had other aircraft that were configured with two 19-shot pods inboard and two 7-shot pods outboard.
Okay.
And normally when you carried the 7-shot pods outboard, you carried nails. The Flechette rockets.
Really?
Yes.
Didn't realize.
Nasty little.
They didn't realize this existed.
The Flechette rockets?
Yeah.
Oh. Great area fire weapon.
Huh.
If you were in a situation where you didn't have to get real close to ground troops, or if you were doing an LZ prep and the ground were dry and you didn't want to start a lot of fires, you nailed it.
Really?
And these things carried 1,200 one-inch finned nails wrapped nose to tail.
Wow.
It would go out about 400 meters, and then an explosive charge would blast the nails out. You'd see a little red puff of smoke to let you know that the nails had detonated.
Wow.
And so, you carry 14 of those and multiply that times 1,200.
A lot of nails.
That's a lot of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that would definitely clean out an area. Not good for use against bunkers.
No.
But, in open areas or lightly treed areas are very effective.
Mm-hmm.
Great weapon to bust up LZ attacks, especially the human wave type of things that the NVA were fond of under certain circumstances.
Uh-huh.
You put two gunships out there with a load of nails on them, stop it cold.
Wow. That must be devastating. Now, selecting armament, would you do that yourself? Would that be done, with the alert sections? How'd that work?
Initially, excuse me, every day at military time, 1600 hours, we'd go in and get our assignments for the following day.
Okay.
Aircraft assignments, crew assignments and section assignments. Then we'd go out and pre-flight our aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
They were always armed at that time.
Okay.
So you took off whatever load the last crew put on it.
Oh.
Then, depending upon the mission or what was going on, you'd come back in and you could select the load. Sometimes, like with the two 19-shot pods, we had 17-pound and 10-pound warheads.
Uh-huh.
Well, if you had a real hot day, you weren't going to carry a full 17-pound load.
Right.
You'd carry 10-pounders, a combination of 10-pounders on the outboard, 17-pounders on the inboard.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you got to the target, depending upon what you needed, you could select inboard or outboard.
Mm.
You could also select the number of rockets you wanted to fire.
Okay.
You could get one pair, two pair, seven, and shoot the whole lot.
Uh-huh.
But they didn't shoot all at the same time.
Uh-huh. Basically ripple fire?
Ripple fire because of the folding fence.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes you'd have a malfunction, and they'd all go at the same time, and that just created rockets going off everywhere. Everywhere. Parts. We had there was a guy, a maintenance pilot who occasionally flew combat missions, a guy named Fred Clemens, came back one day and had a problem, salvoed, and one of the fins of the rocket came back right through the canopy.
Oof.
Damn near got him right between the eyes.
Man.
That was scary. Other times you'd come back and a fin or a part of a rocket had come off and hit the rotor blades or embedded itself in part of the airframe.
Wow.
It was dangerous.
Hmm.
That and hang fires. Huh. When a rocket hung up in the pod and wouldn't release.
Uh-huh.
And that would just, you know, throw the aircraft totally out of trim and burn part of the, you know, burn the pod rear end right off.
Huh.
Unless the rocket released fast enough.
Was there any way to get him out?
You prayed. You prayed, you know, okay, that it would come out.
Divine intervention, I guess, is a way.
That was it, yeah. That was it. Yeah, there was no way of getting it out once it hung up. Mm-hmm. It just had to make up its mind to go.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes, I don't know, there might have been some sand or something, grit, that got into the tubes,
uh-huh,
and it took a while for the thrust of the rocket to work up to get it by that, or
uh-huh,
who knows. It didn't happen too often, but when it did, it got your attention.
Were there any 20-millimeter birds in your unit?
Near the end of my tour, we did get some 20-millimeter birds.
Okay.
And everybody used to fight over flying those.
Really?
Yeah, because, well, it was a... If you got into a situation where and you had 51-caliber anti-aircraft,
uh-huh,
in the area, in a normal configuration, Cobra had to get well within the range of that 51 cal in order to engage it.
Mm-hmm.
With the 20 millimeter, you could stand off, thumb your nose at them, and blast the hell out of them.
Really?
Sure.
Excellent.
And you didn't even have to keep the aircraft in trim.
Uh-huh.
Just wherever you stuck that pipper, that's where those 20 millimeter rounds were going to go.
Huh.
It was a great weapon. Only problem was you could only shoot 25 round bursts because the airplane parts would start coming off.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen a number of pictures of them in First of the Night with the extra armor on the side and everything.
Yeah, they beefed up the structural panels on the forward part of the fuselage and strengthened some of the fasteners. I remember there was a cooling fan on the port side right behind the canopy, mm-hmm, and the door for that used to come off all the time.
Really?
Yeah, that and what was the old... In the old Cobras, there was a battery compartment in the nose, and there was an access hatch there,
hmm,
and that always used to come off.
Really?
But once they put the battery back in the hell hole, that's where we used to keep our lunch.
Oh.
Yeah. You know, throw a couple cans of soda in there and take it up to 13,000 feet for 10 minutes to be ice cold when you get back on the ground.
Huh. Excellent. Now, let's see. I guess October 70... The Aircraft Combat Brigade was organized. 2nd and the 20th was in direct support of that. Reflying missions, supporting their operations?
Yeah, that was about the time that things started changing. Vietnamization was kicking in.
Mm-hmm.
I remember our battery moved from Quan Loi to Camp Bearcat.
Okay.
In between Long Binh and Saigon. And we were supporting brigade operations throughout the eastern part of the area of operations.
Huh.
Initially, we were up around An Loc, Loc Ninh, Budop,
mm-hmm,
when we were out of Quan Loi, and then we moved farther south for a period of time, at least from October of 70 until I left in February of 71. Then things changed after that. Cambodia 2,
mm-hmm,
if you will, happened.
Okay.
Other things. Yeah. And, of course, the breakup of the, you know, the CAV came home and left a brigade separate there.
Uh-huh.
That happened later in 71.
Okay. All right. Now, I was reading something earlier about a prisoner liberation mission in December of 1970. Did you have anything to do with that?
No.
No.
That... I was farther north, and I don't know that the first CAV had anything to do with it. They may have, but
okay.
it was It wasn't anything I was familiar with.
Because supposedly it was in the Razorback vicinity of Warzone C. First cab assets participated in it. It didn't say whether or not the 2nd or the 20th did or not, but I know 1st or the 9th was there.
Yeah, if the 2nd or the 20th was involved at all, it would have been on a, if you will, a standby basis. We weren't used, and that almost sounds like a 1st or the 9th mission, where their scouts, Cobras, and Blues, their ground element, would have been involved. But
yeah.
I don't know that we were.
Okay. I was just wondering, it sounded interesting, sort of a precursor to the Sun Tirade.
Yeah.
Anyway, going into to Cambodia, I guess, you were involved in that.
Yes. In fact, that's staged out of Quan Hoi.
Okay. Was that still, you know, at that point, sort of the forbidden mission, or had you been given permission to do that at that point?
No, the public incursion into Cambodia, that happened on May 1st of 1970.
Okay.
And I can remember being in our quote-unquote officers' club when our battalion commander came in with a map and his aide, and he flipped back the thing and he said, "Gentlemen, you know, this is what we've been waiting for. We can go get him."
Cool.
And we all just kind of like wet our pants because, you know, this was like, we knew they were there.
Yeah.
Because we'd had contact with, in spite of what Jane Fonda and Ramsey Clark had to say about the issue, we knew there were bad guys there.
Right.
And we had been chasing them for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
In what you call, you know, missions fit to the red line, but there was no red line on the ground,
right,
you know, kind of thing. So we had been there, primarily supporting special forces operations into Cambodia.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm. Did you do a lot of the type of mission?
Not a lot, but periodically.
Mm-hmm.
We'd be called upon, you know, we called them Sneaky Pete's.
Mm-hmm.
They were from the 75th Rangers.
Oh.
And the only, you know, they weren't supposed to make contact or be discovered, so periodically they might be discovered, come under fire, and we'd have an emergency extraction.
Huh.
Where we'd provide the close air support and the escort for the aircraft that we're gonna snatch them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. But during the Cambodian operation, the first day, that staged out of Quan Hoi, where Charlie Battery, 2nd of the 20th, was headquartered, and we had a full effort. The first lift that went in, I think the entire battery escorted it.
Wow.
But I don't think we ever fired a shot.
Hmm.
There was no LZ prep because the assault went in next to the to a town called Snoul in Cambodia, S-N-O-U-L, mm-hmm, or something like that. And we were told we could not engage targets within the village.
Hmm.
Except the night before, the bullshit bombers went in and dropped leaflets telling the civilian population that we were coming.
Okay.
I don't know who the genius was that figured out only civilians could read those things.
Right. Sounds like standard army propaganda.
Yeah, it was like, okay, yeah. And so the only fire we took on the initial assault came out of the village.
Huh.
But it wasn't heavy, that I recall.
So you couldn't fire back even though you were fired off?
That's right.
Really?
Right.
Huh. So now, which aircraft, were you assigned a specific aircraft to fly? Just whatever was you drew the night before?
When you became an aircraft commander, it was kind of a ceremonial thing. You were assigned an aircraft.
Okay.
But it really wasn't yours. It belonged to the crew chief.
Uh-huh. Right.
And most of the crew chiefs let you know in no uncertain terms that it was theirs, and you were just, you know, it was on loan to you.
Right.
Okay. But you didn't fly your regularly assigned aircraft.
Okay.
Because of the maintenance schedule that went on.
Mm-hmm.
If your aircraft had 5 more hours before it had scheduled maintenance, you didn't want that aircraft in the hot slot.
Right.
Okay, you wanted one that had 25 hours until scheduled maintenance, because it wasn't uncommon to fly it 12 hours or more in a day,
right?
Especially during the Cambodian operation.
Okay. So, now that would be divided up into several sorties, I guess.
In Cambodia, I can recall one day flying. I believe it was 17 hours during a 1600 to 1600 hour shift. Spending 17 hours in the air, and at one point maybe 8 hours never shutting the aircraft down.
Wow.
Just hot refuel, hot rearm, and go.
Huh.
And that's when flying was not fun in those situations.
Now, which aircraft was yours?
I remember the initial aircraft that I was assigned to had the last three tail number on it. It was 720. It was an old, tired chunk of tin.
Got it right here.
Huh?
I got the Army records of the sea battery. I've got it right here.
720 was the first one I was assigned to. Wow. But the crew chief used to take care of that thing like it was a Corvette.
Wow.
He shined it, you know. I mean, literally waxed it.
Really?
And thinking, I guess, that it would make it go faster. I don't know. But it was just impeccably clean, but it was old.
Uh-huh.
It was old.
Excellent.
And then after that one, I was assigned to, it was 540, I believe, or 520.
Okay.
And I remember that my co-pilot, a kid named Neil McMillan, painted Sound of Silence on the side of it.
Sound of Silence. Okay.
Totally unauthorized.
Really?
Yeah, you know, we weren't allowed to, you know, put nose art on it, but, you know, Charlie Battery, we didn't. Kind of like, what regulation? And he painted Sound of Silence on the side of it.
Excellent.
And big blue letters outlined in white Gothic letters. It was beautiful.
Excellent.
After that, we did Mean Mr. Mustard, Murder Incorporated, The Iron Butterfly, and then I left, so they might have had some after that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, it was Billboard nose art, too. It was awesome.
Excellent. Excellent. Would you happen to have any pictures of it?
I believe I've got a few, yeah.
Excellent. Yeah, I'd love to see that.
It was kind of cool. I think that was 540 with the last three on that.
Okay. Excellent. Yeah, I'm looking here. 720 had the most time in the unit at 2275 hours. Where's that?
It was one of the first aircraft, I think, assigned to the unit. As I recall, in the early 69, second of the 20th became the first all-Cobra unit in Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
Maybe not the first one to receive Cobras, but it was the first one to convert entirely to Cobra inventory. And 720 was one of the old-timers.
Wow. That's great. Now, were there any missions that really stand out in your mind?
Whole bunch of them. The first one that was really stand out was significant was in Cambodia, and it was significant for the entire battery. It happened on May 24th, 1970.
Okay.
And I'd have to check with George Alexander, who was my aircraft commander at the time. Alex and I led a section on a mission to escort Medevac 2-1, which was crewed by Lieutenant Modica and Carbaro, to pick up six wounded South Vietnamese who got themselves into a predicament up in Cambodia.
Uh-huh.
And as we approached the LZ, it was our standard procedure to leave one Cobra high and one to go in with the medevac and do real tight orbits around them to draw any fire that might, you know, be directed towards the medevac. But this mission, they could take it to the ground. As soon as they got to about tree level, all hell broke loose. We were surrounded by bunkers.
Wow.
And I remember looking and actually seeing the slits in the bunkers and being horrified, because it was the first time I'd ever seen tracers in the daytime.
Wow.
They were that thick. Make a long story short, the medevac is shot down.
Uh-huh.
crashed. A medic who was going back to his unit, who was assigned to that South Vietnamese unit, a Sergeant Rocca, was thrown clear, came back, went back into the aircraft, rescued both pilots and one of the crewmen. One crewman was killed in the initial crash. He spent the night with them. They tried to get another bird in to get him out. They couldn't get him out. The next day, we went back with eight Cobras and lost three more aircraft in the LZ rescuing the crews. That Sergeant Rocca earned the Medal of Honor for his actions that day. And I could send you the names of the individuals involved in it.
Wonderful.
A pilot from our unit, Mac Cookson, Chief Warrant Officer, who led the rescue mission the following day, was awarded the Silver Star for his efforts. Georgie Alexander and I, on the first day, got shot up, took some rounds through the tail boom and the rotor blades. Second day was rough. As far as I know, the only U.S. casualty involved, there was another medevac pilot who was wounded, not seriously, and a few other medevac crew members were wounded, but I think the fatality on the first bird that went in was the only fatality amongst the air crew involved in the operation. On the ground, I couldn't tell you. It was a mess. It was a mess. They assaulted 1st of the 9th Blues or 11th. It was either 1st of the 9th Blues or elements of the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment in there. But when they got out, I mean, there were concrete bunkers and dug in anti-aircraft emplacements. The South Vietnamese troops just stumbled onto something that was, you know, really much bigger. I'm surprised they weren't wiped out.
Wow.
Much bigger than they were equipped to handle, but they fought pretty well.
Now, I mean, let's see. I lost my place for a second.
That's fine.
Were there any Cobra losses during that mission?
No, not during that mission.
Okay. Were there losses while you were there?
Yes.
Heavy light?
On June 26th, my wingman was shot down on a pretty routine mission in Cambodia. Just providing security for some engineers who were blowing a weapons cache. And he lost his tail rotor, and 1 second I was looking at him, and a second later he was gone. It took us hours to find him. They rescued him alive. His co-pilot had broken legs, and Jimmy Neighbors, who was a good friend there, had suffered head injuries in the crash.
Really?
And he died a few days later in the hospital.
Were they able to determine the cause of the crash?
Catastrophic tail rotor failure, either mechanical or from hostile fire, but the aircraft was unrecoverable. In fact, we tried to blow it in place. But as far as what they could determine, I think that was the final determination. It had to be something like that, because he went down damn fast.
Wow.
And I had just turned around and I said, we better clear the area. They're going to get ready to blow this thing. And I don't want to be around when it goes off,
Right.
Because you don't know what's going to come up at you. And I looked back at him, and he was off to my left side back about half a mile. And then I heard a mayday call on guard, and when I heard his call sign, I snapped around to look, and he was gone.
Wow.
He was just, that was that quick, he was gone. So it had to be something, something that, like that.
Wow.
And then that very same day, two pilots from B Battery, Denny Bro and Doug Vergamini, were on final approach to a nasty little stinking scab in the jungle called Bujimap, and they flew into a helicopter ambush.
Ooh.
It was shot down, the aircraft disintegrated in the air, and they were both killed.
Did you have much contact with the other batteries?
Off and on, depending upon what was going on. During the Cambodian operation, a B battery came up to Quan Loi, and we had to set up tents. They lived in tents. We lived in little hooches with tin roofs, sandbags around it. I remember we used to park the aircraft nose into the revetments, and if you started them all up at the same time, the rotors would overlap. So they had to start up alternate aircraft, make sure they were parked that way. But B battery was up there. Then we'd swap off logger sites at a place called Fire Support Base Buttons at Songbay. We'd go up for 3 days, and then A battery or B battery would send three ships up. Depending upon where activity was taking place, we'd send a section up just so we were that much closer to the ground troops. Now, if you can cut off, 15 to 30 minutes of flight time, sometimes that can mean the difference between, life and death to the guys on the ground.
Now, here's an odd question, but what kind of uniforms were you wearing? Were they the Nomex flight suits, or were you still wearing the old ones?
No, we wore Nomex flight suits for the whole time that I was there.
Okay.
Occasionally, some of us brought along the cotton one-piece flight suits that we wore at advanced training at Fort Rucker, and those were pretty comfortable just to slip on if you're doing mortar patrol at night, but they weren't really authorized for flight operations anymore. They were just comfortable.
Okay. And had you gotten the new ballistic helmets, or were there still the APH ones?
We had the ballistic helmets.
Oh, you did?
Right. And we weren't forced to wear them. I remember for a long time I wore the APH-4 because I didn't like the ballistic helmet because it was the ear flaps worked too good and you couldn't hear anything.
Really?
You didn't know you were getting shot at until it started banging on the airplane.
Okay. Huh. Interesting. All right. Let's see. I guess I'm out of questions at this point. I've got tons of stuff that I want to know, but I don't know. I guess we've been going for over an hour now. Anything that you'd like to add about your experience there?
No, any help you need, if you're coming up into the area.
Yeah, I shall be back in 2 weeks.
The New England Air Museum. I've got hundreds of slides here. You can use or not use at your discretion.
Excellent. Yeah, I'd love to take a look. You mentioned the New England Air Museum. Actually, I wanted to ask if you knew anything about the Cobra that's there.
No, I don't.
Okay. Because it appears to be a G-Cobra, but it's got a sensor turret in the nose. So I was wondering if you had any idea if that was one of the SMASH program Cobras or anything like that.
Gee, I don't. I really don't. I know that the Army Aviation Heritage Foundation has been thirsting for a G-nose.
Okay.
They've got a, I think it's a TH-1P or something like that. It's got an oddball nose on it. Do you know what kind of canopy this one at the New England Air Museum is?
I think it's not the flat plate. I think it's the smooth canopy.
It's the smooth. That's got to be one of the original, what they called the AH-1S.
Okay.
But I think that was later changed to, boy, oh boy, oh boy. I used to know all this stuff. I've got it written down because I'm an avid modeler, and I'm trying to model every version of the Cobra there is out there. But I know the AH-1S went through a couple of incarnations.
Right, there was the F model and the P model.
Yeah, the P model, and then it got changed, and the flat plate canopy came in, and I have no idea, what that is down there.
Okay. Now, actually, I gathered my wits about me and come up with a couple more questions.
Yeah.
When did you head home?
February 17th or 18th, 1971.
Okay, so this is before the redesignation.
Right.
Okay. Heading home, what was that experience like? I guess going from, well, actually, I should say, how soon before you headed home did you stop flying missions?
About a week.
About a week.
About a week, yeah.
So you did have some cool down time?
It was, I don't remember much of it because I didn't stay very sober. I don't think.
Really? Was there a lot of drinking going on?
Not what you'd call, you know, I mean, there was nobody who was constantly inebriated.
Uh-huh.
When you were flying like that, you wanted a clear head, but
yeah.
If you got a day off, you know, you spent it at the club.
Okay.
Except for, yeah, you know, it was like any other community, you know. You had some teetotalers, and then you had some guys who were serious, you know, two-fisted drinkers.
Uh-huh.
When you're 20, 21 years old, 22, you think you're immortal.
Uh-huh.
I was 23,
huh.
And I was one of the older guys.
Really?
Sure, we had a kid, Bob James. I think he was 19.
Really?
When he got there. Couldn't have been much older than that. You have to remember, most of the warrant officer pilots came right out of high school.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, graduate 17, 18 years old, go directly into the Army, spend 32 weeks in flight school. It's possible that, you know, some of these guys could have come out of flight school at 19 years old.
God, being that age and having that much firepower at your fingertips.
Well, that, you know, that's... I don't think you could get anybody my age to do that.
Mm.
You know, when we stop and think about some of the things we did back then, damn foolish.
Right.
I recall, in fact, I spoke with Georgie Alexander for the first time in 30 years a couple nights ago.
Uh-huh.
And we were talking about some of the stupid things we used to do.
Really?
You know, turning all your lights on to attract anti-aircraft fire so your wingman could get in close, blacked out, and blast them. You know, that was real smart.
Really?
You know.
Did it work?
It worked real good. It worked real good. Fortunately, you know, your depth perception is screwed up at night,
uh-huh.
and so most of the time they were shooting behind and below us, but
okay.
You never know when you could, you know, when you'd run into one that had, you know, didn't understand all of that stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time we'd send, put one up high, turn all the lights on, flash bright, turn on the landing light sporadically and intermittently, and see if you could get them to shoot at you.
Huh.
It worked very, very well. Alex taught me that one.
Very cool.
And stooging around, you know, doing donuts right over the trees, trying to draw fire for a medevac. That was, you know, that was very noble, but pretty stupid.
Right.
You know?
Right. Wow. Now, I guess, was most of the flying at somewhat of altitude, or did you do a lot of nap of the earth as well?
It all depended. We were, by SOP, we were required not to break 1,500 foot minimum altitude.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, you know, put a dive angle on that when you're shooting for ground troops who are, you know, the good guys are on one side of a log and the bad guys are on the other side of a log.
Right.
We're shooting unguided missiles.
Yes.
Not too damned accurate. So you got in as close as you could. I think sometimes we got in so close that the rockets didn't have a chance to arm.
Really?
And we probably stabbed the enemy to death rather than, you know, than blowing them up.
Wow.
I can remember shooting within, on one particular mission, they were so desperate, getting in close enough where we were probably shooting within 20 meters.
Really?
Of friendly troops, maybe even closer.
Were you able to see the friendlies you were supporting?
Most of the time, no, because of the triple canopy jungle and the density of the foliage. They'd mark their positions with a smoke grenade.
Uh-huh.
And then they'd give us a distance and a direction from the smoke. And we'd, just like adjusting artillery,
mm-hmm.
we'd fire a marking pair, and then they would adjust uh-huh. from the marking pair. Some pilots were more, you know, adept than others and could get in closer, and then there were others that, you know, they would do what we called strategic carpet rocket shooting.
Now,
didn't let them get in close.
How effective was the 275 as a weapon? I mean, because it was unguided, etc. I mean, was it really, you know, I guess, just overly effective?
It did what it was intended to do.
Uh-huh.
You know, most of the time, and you know, we all wanted to say, well, we went out there and did this and that. Our job wasn't to kill the enemy. Our job was to get them off the back of the ground troops.
Right.
You know, and you did that. You know, you either, you know, kept them pinned down so the ground troops could break contact if they were outnumbered or in a, you know, at a tactical disadvantage, or you blocked the path of enemy troops so the ground troops, you know, if they had a superior numerical advantage, get them out. Or sometimes, you know, especially at night, if it were a mission where you were trying to just, you know, get the good guys out, especially a LERP team or something like that, you just wanted to make a whole lot of noise,
mm-hmm.
you know, and create confusion. So you didn't have to get in real close and be really accurate. You know, with nails especially, I mean, you wouldn't shoot within 100 meters of friendly troops with those things.
Right.
They were definitely an area weapon. But you know, 10-pound rocket, you could get within 25 meters. You know, if you were confident and knew what you were doing, the aircraft had to be in pretty good trim. You had to know the wind directions and speeds and, you know, there were just so many variables with those things. But after a while, you shot so damn many of them, especially ARA pilots. And I tried to figure out one day how many actual combat missions I was on. And I had 1,100 flight hours, and the average mission was an hour to an hour and a half in duration.
Wow.
So, you know, figure out how many missions you had, and we never came back with ammo.
Uh-huh.
We used it up.
Wow.
We used it up. So how many rockets did you shoot?
Wow.
that's a lot of rockets and a lot of practice.
Huh.
And you do it every day.
Definitely.
You do it every day.
Now, did you have R&R and stuff while you were there?
Yeah.
Where'd you go?
I went to Hong Kong for a week.
Excellent.
Spent a lot of money.
Really?
Oh, I bought custom-made suits and shoes and shirts.
Huh.
You know, tried to drink all the beer in Hong Kong, you know, in 7 days.
Excellent. Now, I guess while you were back in combat operations, did you ever encounter any SA-7s?
No. But the 2nd or the 20th, in their later reincarnation as F Battery of the 79th, which, you know, inherited the Boomax call sign,
right.
They did. There's a very famous incident, and it was commemorated by a painting. I forget who the artist was.
Yeah, actually, I was looking at it today.
Missile, yeah, where the two guys survived.
Yeah.
And I do know a bunch of guys from F-79. Who remember that incident and the goings on around Anlok during the Easter invasion in 72.
Right. Yeah, actually, I have a copy of the history of F Battery from February of 72 to July of 72 right here. I was looking at that. Fascinating stuff. So what was your overall impression of the Cobra? And I know there were some problems early on with tail rotors, et cetera.
Well, you know, initially what would happen is because of the high and hot flight conditions, you'd run out of left pedal when you're pulling a lot of power. So they just switched the tail rotor from the port side to the starboard side, put a little camber in the tail fin, and that seemed to solve that problem.
Okay.
You know, if it had, you know, we always wanted more power, more power, but that was just, you know, Vietnam, when it got really, really hot and humid.
Right.
And it just seemed like you'd suck the guts out of it, and you couldn't make it go.
Really?
But the Huey pilots had even more problems than we did. Yeah. I remember one of the stupid things I did one time is sometimes when we were bored, we'd try to ambush an 01 bird dog or, you know, a lone de Havilland otter. Those were our favorites.
Uh-huh.
One time, myself and another guy tried to ambush a CH-47 Chinook.
Uh-huh.
We didn't know they could go faster than a Cobra.
Really?
He left us standing still.
Really?
Yep.
Huh.
He did. He left us just sitting there like dopes.
Wow.
And I'm glad that he didn't know our radio frequency, so he couldn't make fun of us.
But, that's pretty
funny. That 47 could not outmaneuver, but boy, he could hit, you know, in a foot race, he could beat you.
Really? Yeah. Didn't know that. What was the top end on the Cobra?
Well, loaded, we, as I recall, we used to cruise at somewhere between 110 and 130 knots, but I think it redlined at 180, but you couldn't get that unless you were in a really steep dive,
uh-huh.
And I don't recall ever trying to go that fast.
Yeah.
Empty, again, we never flew them empty.
Uh-huh.
And we always had, something like 1,200 pounds of fuel and a max ordnance load. And it was a job hovering that thing without over-torquing it.
Uh-huh.
Under normal circumstances. And I can recall some days when you had a tired bird and you screwed up, you put on a little too much fuel or a little too much in the way of ordnance, having to make a running takeoff.
Really?
Yeah. And using the runway to get it off the ground.
Huh.
We loaded them up. They were maxed out when we took off.
Excellent. Right. Well, okay. I'm done.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess I'm pretty much tapped out as far as questions go. But let me just officially end this. Just hold on a second. This will officially end the interview with Mr. James Moran on February 27th. Okay, this is Jonathan Bernstein conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Jim Moran. It's the 28th of March, 2002, at approximately 9 a.m. in the morning. A little redundant there. I am in the interview room at Texas Tech Special Collections Library, and Mr. Moran is in Ashburnham, Massachusetts. All right, Mr. Moran, I guess start off where...
the beginning.
Yes, yeah, at the beginning. We're discussing May 24th.
I've put this together from eyewitness accounts, the Medal of Honor citation for Louis Rocco, and an excerpt from a book, U.S. Army Air Ambulance, by Mark Huff. It was published by Vader River Publishing of Bellevue, Washington, in 1999. So some of the some excerpts were taken from that, but basically what happened during the Cambodian operation, an Arvin Airborne unit, and I believe it was a company size unit, established contact with North Vietnamese troops northeast of Khatum, Republic of Vietnam.
Okay.
That contact was initiated on the 23rd of May, and a medical evacuation had taken place on the 23rd, and the LZ was quote-unquote cold. In other words, there was no ground fire.
Mm-hmm.
On the 24th of May, at about 1600 hours, a medevac was scrambled from Quan Loi. It was medevac 2. It was crewed by Steve Modica, who was the aircraft commander, and First Lieutenant Leroy Carbaro, who was the pilot, co-pilot. Along with that, two AH-1Gs were scrambled from C Battery, 2nd of the 20th ARA, at Quan Loi. And those aircraft were crewed by First Lieutenant George Alexander, aircraft commander. Pilot was Warrant Officer 1, Jim Moran. The second aircraft was crewed by Chief Warrant Officer Paul Garrity, the aircraft commander, and Warrant Officer 1, Jimmy L. Neighbors, in the front seat. We dispatched to the area, and as we approached, we made contact with the American advisors on the ground, and they reported that the LZ was cold, although they had 8 wounded Arvin troopers on the ground. I don't know how you get a cold LZ with 8 wounded troopers, but that's how it was. But we took their word for it. Standard procedure was the medevac would set up on an approach to the LZ. One Cobra would go low with him to act as a screen and give him close support as he was going in,
mm-hmm.
and one Cobra would stay high, covering the two birds that were going into the LZ. Med 2 approached on a southeasterly heading, trying to keep the sun at his back, not much wind, so it wasn't a downwind approach.
Mm-hmm.
Alexander and myself went down with him. As we approached the LZ, we could see troops on the ground. That we didn't get any fire, but as Med 2 decelerated, all hell broke loose, and he just we could see tracers in the daylight, which was unusual.
Mm-hmm.
We started to break across his nose, and we saw him get hit. When he went down, Modica was hit in the chest armor by 2 rounds, and he took a round in his left thigh. Carbaro noticed that. He tried to recover the aircraft, not realizing that the engine was disintegrating and the tail boom had severed.
Wow.
Because of the rotor RPM that was still left, the aircraft rose off the ground a little bit, but it rotated on the axis of the rotor system because he'd lost tail rotor
right.
control, obviously, with the severed tail boom. The aircraft landed hard, rolled over, the fuel cells ruptured, and it caught fire. As that was happening, Alexander was breaking left around the front of him. We saw the fire coming out of the southeasterly side, the southeasterly side of the LZ, and he broke really hard right to avoid the fire. We could see it. And as we looked down, we could see bunkers. Apparently what had happened was this Arvin company had stumbled into an NVA bunker complex. We were later told that those bunkers were concrete reinforced, right, which accounts for the fact that we shot a whole lot of rockets at it and really didn't do much damage to them.
Wow.
We went back to altitude. Garrity was screaming for us to get the hell out of the way so that he could put some rockets down on the bunkers where most of the fire was coming from. Alexander and I went back to altitude, and we set up our daisy chain trying to, with the American advisor on the ground, putting down suppressive fires, trying to knock out some of these bunkers. At about that time, an aircraft, a Huey from B Company, 229th, and his call sign Killer Spade 4, came on the scene, had heard what was going on, and volunteered to make an attempt to go in and pick up the downed crew. He got to short final, and he took heavy fire, disabled his aircraft, but he was able to fly it out a short distance away, land, and another aircraft from the 229th picked him and his crew up and evacuated them. They kind of, as it were, flew off into the sunset, and we never heard from them again. Some real gutsy guys, and they're not mentioned at all in any of the accounts that I've been able to find of this particular incident.
Okay.
After he left, we were getting low on ammunition, but Medevac 1, that was commanded by Captain Henry Toole III,
okay.
That's T-U-E-L-L,
mm-hmm.
Also from the 15th Medical Battalion. He came in. Alexander and I went with him and tried to insert him into the LZ, and that was a no-go. His aircraft took heavy fire, as did we, but we had the advantage of having a little airspeed and being able to maneuver where the medevac was just a sit and duck decelerating into the LZ.
Right.
Toole did not crash. He got out, landed a short distance away, and his crew was picked up during this whole thing. Excuse me. No, he flew it out. He was not heavily damaged. I'm
okay.
Sorry. Correct myself.
Okay.
He flew it out. Looking at the notes here. Yeah, he took off. He made it out of there heavily damaged. Okay. while all of this was going on, we were getting low on fuel and low on bullets. We scrambled another section of Cobras out of Quan Hoi.
Okay.
And I'm having a little trouble putting this together. I do know that Chief Warrant Officer Mac Cookson was the aircraft commander and section leader. Warrant Officer 1 Gary White was in one of the aircraft. We're trying to determine who the other crew members were. We've got a pretty good read on it, but we haven't been able to determine that yet.
Okay.
They tried to get another medevac in that was piloted by First Lieutenant Tom Reed. That aircraft was damaged and the fuel cells were pierced.
Okay.
They landed a short distance away, and they were picked up by another aircraft and evacuated.
Okay.
A fourth attempt was made by Chief Warrant Officer Ray Zepp, Medevac 2-3, to get his aircraft in, but he was shot down. Managed to get it away from the LZ, but his aircraft was disabled, and he was also picked up. By that time, it was getting a little dark.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had one aircraft already destroyed, three down, and two damaged. Okay? Tools aircraft and the Cobra that I was in. We took hits in the tail boom and rotor system. But
how bad a damage was it?
It wasn't bad. It was, in fact, as I recall, when we got it back, they changed the rotor blades and put duct tape over the bullet holes.
Hmm.
That was how you repaired sheet metal real quick. We could not get anything in there at night. I mean, it would have been suicide to try to go back in at night. The following day, we put together a planned rescue attempt that involved several medevac choppers, which had to be borrowed from other units because Charlie Company, which was supplying all of these medevac choppers on the first day, had run out of airplanes.
Hmm.
They just didn't have anything that would fly. Mac Cookson led two heavy fire teams of three Cobras each up to the LZ. And we did a very heavy rocket prep before attempting to get aircraft in for the rescue. Several of those aircraft were disabled, but all the crews were rescued. The final bird in was the command and control ship, and they evacuated the rest of Modica's crew, and we put the whole thing to bed on the 25th.
Okay. Now, when, I guess, stepping back to when it first started, what altitude were you operating at? I mean,
what altitude?
Any idea what altitude?
We were approximately, I'm going to say, to get that close, we were anywhere from, at various times, from 50 to 200 feet above ground level.
Okay.
Airspeed going into the LZ probably no more than 50 knots.
Oh, really?
While we were decelerating with the medevac to shield him as he went in.
Okay.
We would normally slow down with him, and then as he made his, we tried to time it, as he made his landing, we would break across his front at low speed to shield him, and then we would take up a low-level orbit using the turret weapons, the miniguns, which I did fire ineffectively. Just trying to make some noise. And, we didn't know how many bad guys were down there, but they were all over the place. Somebody said that later that artillery was impacting in the area, and we're saying, you know, I don't remember any artillery, and I don't know anybody. I don't know that it would do any good because the NVA were in the perimeter.
Right.
And it was just people all over the place. It took a while for the Arvin to establish any kind of concerted defensive positions and settle in for the night.
Okay. Now, that Arvin company that was there, I mean, they'd been inserted the day before. How come, I mean, any idea of why they didn't stumble into these bunkers at that point? Or, I mean,
well, I think they realized, you know, in the area that they were, I mean, you could be in Vietnam, you could be sitting on top of one of these things and not even know it.
Right.
Especially in the jungled area, and the North Vietnamese were masters at camouflage.
Mm-hmm.
You stand right next to one of them, and you wouldn't know he was there, okay, unless you could smell him.
Right.
But I think the Arvin had discovered this, and the area that they were looking at, whether the NVA came back in during the night and reinforced it, the bunker complex,
mm-hmm.
or whether the South Vietnamese had just stumbled on an unoccupied area,
right.
because these bunkers surrounded the LZ that we were working on, and I don't, you know, whether the Arvin airborne troops had been inserted in there, and you know, the NVA let them come in.
Right.
That bothers me, because the NVA would never, you know, resist the chance of blasting a couple of helicopters that were sitting on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So I get the gut feeling that if there were any there when the Arvin were first inserted, they weren't at strength and decided they weren't going to pick a fight right then.
Okay. All right. And did the Arvin on the ground have any role in the rescue attempt?
They were fighting for their lives.
Right. Okay.
Those guys were, you know, during the night, certainly they provided security for Medica and Cobb Rowe and Louis Rocco and the other surviving crew member of the of Medevac 2.
Mm-hmm.
The gunner, a kid named Taylor, was killed in the crash when the aircraft rolled over on it in the Medevac crew.
All right. Hmm. Now, the aircraft you were flying that day, was that 049?
We have not been able to determine the serial numbers on the aircraft, although I have sent a request in to the National Archives, their Southeast Asia division.
Excellent.
Looking for after-action reports or daily journals, which were kept of aircraft assignments.
Okay,
so I'm trying to find those. Nobody has been able to recall which aircraft were involved. We thought we could get something from the Army Gold Book because it kept records of dates and battle damage to certain aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought, well, at least the one Alexander and I was in, we knew we had battle damage, but it was repaired at unit level.
Right.
Consequently, no report, you know, we think no report went in of it.
Okay.
And those Gold Book records are highly inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
I found just with the 2nd of the 20th, we found numerous errors, reporting errors, and I think some of it was made up.
Really?
The truth.
Uh-huh. That's always interesting.
Yeah, I don't place a lot of faith in those. I have photographs of aircraft with clear tail numbers, and they're not listed as having ever been served with 2nd of the 20th.
Mm.
And so...
Yeah.
I don't know what happened. In talking to the people at the National Archives, I did mention that there was a period of time where the 1st Cavalry Division did not keep good records or erroneously destroyed records.
Hmm.
Okay. For example, Louis Rocha was awarded the Medal of Honor, but not until after, sometime after he got out of Vietnam, because the recommendations for the citations were lost.
Hmm.
So had to enlist the aid of congressmen and other people to get it for him. In fact, I talked to Paul Garrity a short time ago, and he was surprised to hear that Louis had gotten it, because Garrity had written up a recommendation for the citation, as did George Alexander, Steve Modica, and Leroy Carbaro. And all of that stuff was lost.
Mm-hmm.
So Garrity was extremely happy to hear that Rocco did get the award. What's really strange about the whole thing is Garrity and Alexander were written up by the Medevac crews, and the recommendations for them were lost. Consequently, they received they were not decorated for their actions that day.
Hmm.
And not that they cared about it, but they did a. They stuck their necks out. Had they not offered themselves up as targets, it could have been a lot worse.
Mm.
A lot worse. I didn't have much to do. I had to go where Alexander went. I spent the whole time in the front seat trying to hide in my helmet.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that was scary. And when you're sitting in the front seat of a Cobra, it's like having balcony seats at the opera. You're just hanging right out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you think everybody in the world is looking at that target painted on your head.
Guess what they call a high pucker factor?
There you go. There you go. And you couldn't wait to get in the back seat because you could hide back there.
Yeah.
You know? And when I made aircraft commander, there's a little guy in the unit, a short, squat fella named Neil McMillan. And I said, I'll take him. And they said, what do you want him for? I said, because he's going to wear a chicken plate. And if they put anything through the chicken plate, him, and the instrument panel, I deserve to die. You know?
Okay. I was looking through your slides, and there were two shots of medevac bird. Would that one happen to be one of the aircraft involved? Do you know?
Those photographs were taken later.
Okay.
Probably not one of the aircraft involved,
okay.
But if I remember correctly, the pilot of the aircraft commander of that particular medevac ship was a guy named Cecil Montgomery Halcombe.
Okay.
He was medevac 8. Okay. He was flying right seat for Hank Toole on May 24th.
Okay.
He was not yet an aircraft commander.
Yeah, actually, I'm looking at the nose right now, and it looks like on the right-hand side it says medevac 8. That's possible. Okay.
It could. If it says medevac 8 or Angel of Mercy, that was Halcombe.
Okay.
He was flying right seat for Hank Toole. Okay. That was the second medevac bird that tried to get in to rescue Matika and Carvero.
Okay.
Now, what other slides do you have there?
Actually, I've got them all right here.
Oh, okay.
I was looking. I pulled the ones of various individuals who were involved. I've got the shot of Cooks and Toole right here.
Okay.
Looks like it's at some party or something.
That was that photograph was taken at our quote unquote officers' club at Camp Bearcat.
Okay.
Probably, we had a big party. If Cookson is wearing a blue paisley smoking jacket, that was his going away party.
Okay, no, he's wearing the standard Nomex flight.
Standard Nomex. Okay, that was a party where we got a day off. We invited the medevac crews in. I think we were christening the club.
Okay.
Because Modica was at that party too.
All right.
He'd recovered from his leg wound and was back, but I think he was just about. In fact, it may have been a going away party from Modica and Toole.
Okay.
And now that I recall, because they left shortly after that party. Cookson went home in, I want to say, December of 70, November or December of 70.
Okay. Yeah. Toole's, Cookson is wearing, and it looks like an Australian.
That's an Australian bush hat that he picked up on. R&R in Australia.
Huh. Very cool. Did you head down there as well?
I wanted to, but no. In fact, it took me a long time to get R&R, and I ended up going to Hong Kong.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Garrity went to Australia and spent the whole week in bed.
That sounds pretty cool. Now, at any time during the mission, I mean, did you feel like you were going to get shot down? And were was the anti-aircraft fire that heavy?
I don't know, initially when we saw the tracers, there was a wall of them. Had Alexander not broken hard right, we would have been tattooed good.
Right.
And he saw them, they were coming up in front of us. And had we continued our left-hand turn, we'd have flown right through it. So when he broke right, he put a lot of tin between those guns and us,
mm-hmm.
and came back the other way and struggled, you know, to just get out of there. But Garrity came while we were moving out. Garrity was in a rocket run, and he started putting them in, and he was a little off with his first pair or two, and then he just put a whole load of them right on the bunkers.
Okay.
So that saved our necks, too. But they just had all kinds of stuff there. I don't. The hits that we took were 30 caliber.
Okay.
They weren't 51 cal. You get hit by a 51 cal, you'd know it.
Mm.
Literally, it would tip the airplane over.
Really?
Yeah. They packed a punch. Mm. Packed a punch.
Okay. Now, were your rocket runs and minigun having any effect on the enemy positions? Were you aware of that?
We don't know.
Okay.
We don't know. There were just a lot of people down there in, as I said, concrete reinforced bunkers. Obviously, they weren't given up because every aircraft that tried to get in there got shot up.
Right.
And on that first day, the only aircraft that were not damaged were the ones that Garrity, Cookson, and Cookson's wingman were flying.
Okay.
Every other aircraft that got within the perimeter of that LZ got hit.
Okay.
The aircraft that were at altitude did not get hit.
Mm-hmm.
Probably because the fire was coming from the bunkers, and they probably couldn't bring their weapons to bear.
Right.
Okay, on anything that was at altitude.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as we got down below tree level,
mm-hmm.
They blasted everything.
Yeah, I'm trying to come up with these questions. Oh man,
that was a situation. If we had had something like the SS-11s or some wire-guided missiles or something like that, or even a 20-millimeter cannon with armor-piercing rounds, we may have been able to do some damage to the bunkers.
Okay.
But those 2.75-inch HE rockets with, like, throwing tennis balls at them, unless you put one right through the aperture, or you, the concussion, if you hit them real heavy with multiple rounds, the concussion might kill the occupants, or, you might get some shrapnel that would splash through the aperture, but these guys were not, they were not amateurs.
Right. These were definitely NBA.
Hmm?
They were definitely NBA.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Now, any idea what type of weapons load you had for that day?
What load we had? Standard would have been 17-pound HE.
Okay.
And if we were carrying in a heavy hog configuration, two tubes would be carrying approximately 15 17-pounders each. And then we would load the outboard tubes with 10-pounders.
Okay.
If we were in a light configuration with 19 shots inboard and 17-shot rockets outboard, we'd either load up the inboards with 10-pounders and the outboards with 17s,
mm-hmm.
or put a reduced load of 17s on the inboard and a full load of 17s on the outboard.
Okay. Was there any difference in effectiveness between the two types?
The 17-pounders made a louder bang.
Okay.
The 10-pounders were a little more accurate.
Okay.
But we got to the point where we could stick those things through the window of a truck if we had to.
Really?
I've fired as close as 15 meters to friendly troops.
Wow.
With the rockets. But you got in close.
Yeah.
They had to go, I believe they had to go 400 meters before they'd arm.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a standard operating procedure was we did not break 1,500-foot AGL. That's what the book said.
Uh-huh.
Okay, in a rocket run. But I don't ever remember, except on my AC check ride, of ever pulling out before I hit 1,500 feet. That's where we started
mm-hmm.
our rocket run.
Right.
If you were firing 100 meters from friendly troops, that was kid stuff.
Mm.
But in Vietnam, most of that contact in the jungle, they were 10 to 25 meters.
Mm.
So if you were going to do anything, you had to get it in close.
Right.
And the closer you got, the more accurate you were going to be.
Hmm. It's a whole new meaning of the term close air support.
What's that?
So it gives a whole new meaning to the term close air support.
Danger close. Danger close. Yeah. When we got within those things at the end, we had to get the ground commander's initials and permission. But we always fired danger close.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what the hell good, you know, I can remember, you know, Air Force fast movers coming in doing their quote-unquote close air support. What good is it to drop a 250-pound bomb 200 meters from the contact?
Right.
That doesn't hurt anybody.
No, it just makes a big mess.
It gets their attention. It makes a very loud noise. But, you know, same with artillery.
Mm-hmm.
We'd use artillery for blocking fires.
Mm-hmm.
Right? A lot of times we'd be on a mission and we'd want to trap the bad guys and mm-hmm. maintain contact. We'd use artillery and fast movers as for blocking fires to keep them bottled up.
Mm-hmm.
But to get in close, you had to, you know, sometimes they'd bring in OH-6s with miniguns on them.
Really?
And they'd hover around in the trees. That's why if you're doing your research, mm-hmm. you look at how many OH-6s were shot down.
Yes.
Those guys were industrial strength stupid. They were just, you know, I mean, you know, the joke was, you know, over there is, you know, Loach pilots, you just strap that to the ass of a warrant officer one and tell him he's a hero and he'll try to win the war by himself. You know, the scout pilots were crazy. You'd never get me doing that.
Yeah, I've read a lot of, you know, spoken to a couple of veterans as well, you know, mainly AirCav. Basically just sending the Loach down low to have people shoot at him.
Target practice. And
yeah.
Those guys had, pardon the vernacular, but they had balls.
Mm.
And they would get in there. I just could not believe the guts that those Loach drivers had. They were either crazy, stupid, or the bravest people in the world. next to the medevac crews. I had nothing but the you know, absolute respect for medevac crews. Those guys never said no, and they never quit.
Mm.
They would go in the worst damn weather, in the middle of the night, hot LZ, they just went.
Wow.
You know, they went. They never said no. Well, medevac Meadow is a perfect example of it.
Mm.
They just kept feeding people into that thing. And they'd see, you know, the bird in front of them would go down. They'd say, okay, my turn.
Mm.
You know, gutsy guys. Really gutsy guys.
Any idea what, I guess, what drove people to do that? To sacrifice themselves like that?
There, you know, you've heard the cliche, after a while, you know, you weren't fighting for mom, apple pie, country, or any of that. You were
right.
Fighting for one another.
Yeah.
And it was just a dedication amongst the helicopter crews, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to Matt Cookson the other night about this, and, you know, he said that during the time he was there, there was only one guy in the unit that he would not fly with.
Really?
Yeah, and it was the same for me.
Hmm.
There was nobody in that unit except for one guy that I wouldn't fly with.
Same
guy? In a heartbeat. And if one of your pals went down, you did everything to get him.
Hmm.
You know? I mean, we didn't care about the machines. The Army had tons of machines.
Right.
You know, we cared about the people, so we'd just go get them.
Hmm.
And you developed a rapport. We became very, very close with the medevac crews.
Mm-hmm.
We had many, many aircraft shot up shielding those guys. And we'd literally just stick ourselves between them and the bad guys because they were defenseless.
Mm.
You know, they were trying to, you know, they got a medic and maybe the crew chief hanging out the door on a hoist trying to lug some poor grunt up through the jungle on a jungle penetrator or rigid litter if he was seriously injured.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody in the world could see him. You know, so the little people in the bushes with their AK, you know, Uncle Ho put a big floral ribbon on their chest if they whacked a helicopter. That was a big deal for them. You know, get a helicopter, you were a hero.
Wow.
So they, you know, that Red Cross meant nothing to them.
Really?
In fact, later in the war, some dumbass rear echelon type decided they should paint the medevac choppers white.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, I mean, we had some people over there that, you know, weren't thinking right.
Yeah.
You know, and they were primarily one of the problems we had was people rotated through too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just got good at it, and you went home.
Right.
You know?
And no chance of.
Yeah, and that was even with the commanders.
Yeah.
You know, by the time those guys got good at it, they sent them home.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you take a look at the grunts. I mean, you know, your platoon leaders, those guys would be out in the field for 6 months,
mm-hmm.
and then they'd send them to the rear.
Yeah.
You know, well, what? Heck, 6 months? You just figured out how to read a map.
Yeah. You know?
And the same flying the helicopters. And standard procedure was after you had 100 hours or 3 months in country, at least in our unit, they'd start working you up to aircraft commander.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you had anything going for you. But during an entire tour, you flew over 1,000 hours, and you really didn't know what was going on until you had about 500 hours under your belt. So you got 500 hours under your belt being stupid, and then you start getting good at it, and just about that time they send you home.
Yeah.
You know? So that created a problem over there,
mm-hmm.
as far as experience went.
Yeah, it seems to be fairly universal. Just about everybody I've spoken to has said the same thing.
Yeah. Of course, we weren't unhappy when they sent us home, believe me.
Exactly.
You know, you'd get... the last month you were there, you were walking on eggs.
Mm.
And Mac Cookson got shot down on his last mission.
Really?
And he took the mission. He had already processed out of the unit and was supposed to go down to Benoit to process out and go home.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know who the pilot was in the unit, but he was sick as a dog. He was violently ill.
Mm-hmm.
So Cookson said, well, I'll take your flight. It's going to be a milk run. I don't know what it was, but he went up, and as he started his rocket run and pulled out, he got stitched right across the belly, and the airplane started having bad feelings. You know, the engine didn't like that, and Cookson crashed it in a bomb, in a daisy cutter LZ.
Ooh.
Crash landed. And when he got back to the operations area, our operations officer, Captain Marion Ray, who was a great guy, just looked at Cookson and said, I'm not even writing that mission up. I'm not reopening your file. You know, just get out of here. When he got down to battalion headquarters, the battalion commander said, I don't know whether to kiss you or court-martial you, but I'm going to tell you one thing. I don't want to see your face again. Get out of here.
Wow.
But,
Now, Medevac Meta, was it on the Vietnam side or the Cambodian side of the Red Line?
No, it was on the Cambodian side.
Okay. See, I was just looking at the map.
Excuse me?
I was just looking at a 1968 map of...
Yeah, it was in the region called the Fishhook.
Right.
And it happened probably... It was northeast of Katoom and probably west of Loc Ninh. Loc Ninh was an interesting place.
Really?
Well, we used to do what we called loggers up there, where we just land on this little airstrip mm-hmm. and hang around waiting to support troops in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't know at the time, but the North Vietnamese were digging holes right under where we were sitting.
Really?
Sure. That was one of their, I think it was War Zone C or D. I'm mm-hmm. not sure. They were both up there. But Loc Ninh was an area where... there was a heavy concentration of NVA. They'd do their thing and then slip back across the border,
mm-hmm.
and we couldn't chase them.
So when did you become aware that there was a tunnel complex there?
I didn't know it until after the war.
Really?
Yeah, when they started finding all these things.
Wow.
You know? And, of course, the North Vietnamese were... You know, for propaganda purposes, we're crowing about it, saying, you dumb Americans. You know, you were sitting right on top of us and didn't even know it.
Mm-hmm.
George Tebbets got mad at Alexander and I because we were flying one of the only aircraft with an air conditioner in it.
Uh-huh.
And we saw some NVA popping out of spider holes one day. And so we racked it around and came in low level, and we're firing the minigun and the 40-millimeter grenade launcher. And one of them popped out of the spider hole and fired one of the golden BBs at us.
Oh, no.
And it hit the air conditioning unit. George Tebbets wanted us, you know, persecuted for war crimes for that one.
That's terrible.
Yeah. He said that was a war crime.
Now, I've been going through all of the slides of various aircraft and everything, and, you know, of course, I emailed you the other day about 674 and my thoughts as far as it being Murder, Inc.
I don't know. That's why I'm trying to get hold of Jet Jackson.
Okay.
But he'd be able to let me know on that. See, there's an aircraft that's not even listed on this on the Charlie Battery inventory.
Yeah, I was looking
at it. And it's obviously got the big red circle on the nose.
Yeah.
You know, so.
And actually, there's another shot of it in Shelby Stanton's uniforms of the Vietnam War.
Uh-huh.
It's, oh, I can't think of the guy's name. Anyway, but it's a right side shot of it, and it had the name on both sides.
Right, so we put the names on both sides.
So,
in fact, you'll see when I send you the photos of 054,
mm-hmm.
you'll notice the variation in the layout of the name from the port side to the starboard side.
Okay.
One of them, on one side, the bottom silence is sort of convex, and on the other side it's concave.
Okay.
Slight variation, but you'll see it.
All right. Now, was 054 a 20-millimeter bird?
No. No, that was a heavy hawk.
Okay.
So, it was heavy.
All right. Any idea how many 20-millimeters were in the unit?
When I left, I believe we had two.
Okay.
We had two. Now, there is a photograph. Golly. I'm trying to think of where I saw it, of the one that's marked Murder, Inc.,
uh-huh.
and that had the 20-millimeter removed.
Really?
Yes. It still had the structural reinforcement on the forward part of the fuselage. I don't know if it had the saddle ammo bays on it, but obviously it had, on the port wing, it was in a heavy hog configuration.
Wow.
You know, that was after I left. I know we never, the 20-millimeter birds, we'd fight over to fly those,
yeah.
It was a new toy, but it was, I mean, you didn't have to be in trim or anything to fire the rockets. You had to fly the aircraft on a string.
Mm-hmm.
You had to be perfectly in trim and have a constant angle of attack, or the rockets just, you know, they would weather vane.
Mm-hmm. So
if you were out of trim and all, but that 20 millimeter, I mean, you just punch in pedal, and wherever you put the pipper, that's where the bullets were going to go.
Hmm.
We loved that thing. Plus, we could duke it out with 51 cals because we could get, you know, standoff range. Then it was a fair fight.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, you had to get within the 51 cals range, and that wasn't healthy.
Right. Okay.
In fact, I did find. For you, if you're going to use them, I'll send them out to you. I found photographs of a triangular helicopter ambush.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
So I'll get those off to you.
Oh, that'd be great.
And you can use them if you know, actually anywhere,
okay.
You know, as an example of what they looked like and what the crews were up against. And the Cobra pilots would have absolutely no qualms about duking it out with those damn things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you don't forget, we were 20, 21 years old.
Uh-huh.
We really were naive, and we thought we were immortal.
Mm-hmm.
And there was just, you know, something about, you know, flying those helicopters that made you feel invincible, you know, or invisible, one or the other. I don't know. But, I mean, you're talking about some nutty kids out there. I wouldn't do it today.
Mm-hmm.
No way. You know, I think I'll stay in bed. You go ahead. Have a good time.
Yeah, it's funny. Dave Tila pretty much said the same thing. It was interesting hearing his take on things. But he said, yeah, you know, it was an awful lot of responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. You know, I mean, the Huey crews here, you could have two 20-year-old kids in the front seats, okay, commanding a mission with, you know, another 8, 10 aircraft behind them, each one carrying 8 to 10 troops. Okay? And these two kids are responsible for their lives.
Yeah.
Now, that's amazing. That's you know, that's not like, I mean, go the next time you go to McDonald's, okay, you take a look at the manager there, all right, some young kid.
Mm-hmm.
Now put that guy in a helicopter.
Right.
Right, and you scratch your head and you go like, wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, it is. Pretty amazing.
It is. It's astonishing. You know, you get some 25-year-old guy, and we call him Grandpa.
Wow.
Sure. How old are you?
I'll be 29 in September.
You'll be 29. You were ancient back then. 29, my God.
Huh.
You know? Imagine, at 29, imagine being a battalion commander. Okay? Imagine, you know, being, at 29, being a company commander, commanding a whole company, you know, 18 Hueys, and all the pilots and ground crews. You're in charge. It's just, you know, you put that in the context of what we're looking at today, and you go, my God.
It certainly puts things in perspective.
I think it was Paul Garrity one time tried to figure out how many dollars worth of rockets he fired when he was over there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was like, well, you know, 1,000 hours, average mission, an hour and a half. We flew very, very few admin missions in the Cobras because we were on call all the time. Training was OJT, so there were no quote-unquote training missions. So you could have 600 or 700 combat missions, and we never came back with any bullets.
Mm-hmm.
We used them all. So, you know, figure an average, you know, 600 or 700 missions, and you're dumping 60 rockets on each mission. That's a lot of explosives.
Yeah. Now, how effective were the turret weapons? I mean, I know we discussed the Chunker last time, but I mean, how was the minigun?
Minigun was a good suppressive fire weapon. We always used it if we were in a hot situation. The wingman would always use the minigun and to, you know, throw out a spray of it into the area just to cover the break of the ship that was on a rocket run.
Okay.
Medevac Meadows. When we used the minigun when we were low, we were taking fire. It was good for close in. Get pretty close with it, and it would, you know, it would keep their heads down.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, we never saw the people we were shooting at because you know, the jungle was so dense.
Right.
We were just, you know, pretty much being directed like artillery. You know, we'd fire a marking pair, and then the ground commander would adjust our fire.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, they'd throw a smoke grenade out, and then they'd give us a distance and direction from the smoke to the enemy contact. We'd shoot outside of it first, just to get the marking pair down, make sure everything was working right, that the bore sight was good, and once we felt comfortable with that, then we'd start working it in close. So if he told us initially that he had a contact at 090, 25 meters, we'd put the first rockets 50 to 75 meters out.
Okay.
And then if they went where we wanted them to, then he'd adjust us in and we'd move in closer.
Okay. Now, what was the effective, blast radius of the 10s as compared to the 17s?
You know, I used to know, but I don't. And what would happen, too, is, don't forget, these weapons were fired at an angle.
Mm-hmm.
So when the blast, when it exploded, the explosion, the shrapnel pattern would go in the direction of the rocket's flight.
Okay.
It wouldn't explode directly up. It would kind of splash out straight.
Okay. Excellent. Yeah, it was, also, since our last discussion, I've come across a lot of references to Flechette rockets.
Nails?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think Georgie Alexander used to refer to those as Trump, because you didn't use those in close.
Okay.
Definitely an area fire weapon. Probably one of the best examples of that, and I wish you could talk to George Alexander because he's got a better handle on the story than I do, but in 1971, after I left, Charlie Battery was going back into Cambodia in support of Arvin troops, mm-hmm. and this was 1971. A pilot in our unit who was a co-pilot when I was there named Joe Perez.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, there's a picture of him here.
Joe, okay. Mm-hmm. Joe had screwed up, had gone back to rearm after a mission, and they accidentally gave him a load of nails. Mm. As he got back up, he caught several hundred NVA in the open and nailed them. Right? When they assaulted troops in, they found something like 250 to 300 bodies.
Wow.
And what had happened was he had caught them in the open. It was the NVA pay call.
Huh.
They were getting paid. And from what Alexander told me, they found hundreds of thousands of piastres.
Wow.
Which was Vietnamese money. He had actually caught these guys while they were getting paid.
Huh.
And he got a Distinguished Service Cross for that mission.
Really?
Yeah. I haven't seen the citation. You'd have to talk to... Alex got the story because he stayed in the service later, and he ran into some guys later on, and they told him the story, and it was amazing.
Hmm.
Doug Foster, I should have you talk to him. He's up in Oregon. We called him Trapper. He was Trapper John before MASH.
Really?
Yeah. Well, the reason was he was the vector control officer.
Okay.
And that's the guy who's in charge of keeping vermin out of the camp.
Ah, I gotcha.
So he used to come up with all these bizarre traps to trap rats. So we called him Trapper John.
Okay. Very cool.
Any questions on any of the photos that you're going to use?
Let's see. Well, I've basically been going through them aircraft by aircraft. I've done a couple sketches of, profiles and stuff. And I'm hoping, I was told I could use up to 40 aircraft profiles, so I'd like to use 4 different aircraft. I'm really intrigued by number 600.
600 was the twin minigun ship, yep.
Yeah.
That was crewed by a kid named Carlton.
Okay.
His last name was Carlton, C-A-R-L-T-O-N.
Okay.
It was one of the few. In fact, now see, here's a situation. I got to get you to talk to Mac Cookson.
Okay.
Because Cookson was the armament officer,
right.
And it was his idea to put twin minis in that aircraft.
Okay.
And he got the idea when he went to armament officer school at Vung Tau.
Okay.
So you got to talk to Cookson. He'll tell you about 600.
Okay.
He'll also tell you about the black tail boom on 049.
Okay.
That was a quote-unquote clandestine operation aircraft.
Right.
And
nobody knows who we are.
Huh? Nobody knows who we are. We've got the big blue cross on the pylon, and we travel in pairs, and, but nobody knows who we are. The Army brass after Cambodia decided that we would no longer be allowed to use our Blue Max call signs. They're going to change the call signs every 2 weeks.
Oh, really?
Okay. But we still left the Blue Max on the pylons. And at one point, they gave us a call sign of Supreme Capon. The battalion commander went absolutely berserk and absolutely refused to use that call sign.
That's funny.
But when I left Vietnam, my call sign was Perkins Tank 67 Charlie. And
that's
we thought
mouthful.
That was very appropriate because those dipwicks, rear echelon guys, tried to use us like tanks, So, but we'd go out and we'd tell the, we'd make contact with the ground troops who were, taking fire, and we'd say, this is, Supreme Capon 67 Charlie, and they said, we don't want you guys, we called for Blue Max. We said, well, damn it, we are Max. They said, where'd you get that stupid call sign? Don't worry about it, what's your problem here? So, it was bizarre, but,
Huh.
I'd, gave the guys in the rear something to do, I guess. I don't know. I think the guys who came up with that were the ones that came up with the idea of painting the medevac birds white.
Probably the same guys.
Just really dumb stuff.
Actually, you know what? I'm looking at the slide of Murder, Inc. right now, and it is in a heavy hog configuration. That's bizarre. Huh.
Now, which photo is this?
That's the nose shot of Murder, Inc.
With the crew chief sitting on the...
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that guy's name is Ray Winkle. I've got a email out to him, but I haven't... Steve Ray Winkle, I haven't gotten a response from him yet. I'm going to have to rattle his cage, because I'm trying to get the tail number confirmed on it. And that definitely had the 20mm on the port side.
Yeah, that's bizarre.
Okay, so... I don't ever recall them, changing it or whatever, but unless the gun, was pulled for maintenance and they just strapped a rocket pod on there.
Okay.
I don't know.
Did you have any birds in the unit with the minigun pods?
No. We were strictly rockets. The units that I think... D Company 227th and D Company 229th had a lot of those birds in the cav.
Yeah.
And I believe the 1st of the 9th also had some birds with miniguns on them.
Okay. Yeah, because from what I've seen, that seemed to be an earlier rather than a later weapon.
The minigun pod?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it had a lot to do with the mission they were involved in, too. When you're talking about, for example, D Company 227th and 229th, their gunships would probably want to use miniguns because they had to get in real close if they got in a situation where there was a hot LZ.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd want something that was fairly accurate, that they could work in close.
All right. I've been having such a blast going through these slides. Just amazing shots here.
Have fun. There's more coming.
Great. So now, was 049 the only one painted with the blacktail boom?
Boy, you've got me there. I don't believe it was. I think we had a couple more.
Okay.
I think we had at least one more. In fact, I've got to check some slides. I've got a photograph of Gary White hanging off the tail boom of one. And it looks like it's got a black tail boom.
Okay. Yeah, I'm looking at the shots of 600 right now. Now, I've seen a lot of them with just the empty red circles on, with no call sign, lettering in it.
Yeah, as time went on, the later birds did not have the number, if they were repainted or something to that effect. It was the older birds that had the call signs painted in the circle.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I think there's a photograph of myself there next to Tango 1.
Yes.
All right. That was 720.
Okay.
All right. The later aircraft that I was assigned to, 054, did not have Tango 1 painted in the circle.
Okay. Yeah, actually, I just found the shot. There it is. Okay. It's funny, I've noticed everybody with these low-slung pistol holsters. Sort of a cowboy-esque look.
That was not an affectation.
Really?
Okay. There was a purpose for that, especially for the guys who like to carry 45s.
Oh.
What you'd do is, if you were going into a hot LZ or something like that, you'd slide that around in front of the family goodies.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Extra protection.
Now, you'll see the guys with 38s. The guys with 38s like to carry them in shoulder holsters.
Uh-huh.
Okay? On the left side, near their heart.
Makes sense.
We were ordered to wear the chicken plates.
Actually, yeah, I was about to ask about that.
Okay, but we never wore them. What we'd do is we'd take them out of the carrier,
mm-hmm.
And take them and get rid of the back plate because they're terribly uncomfortable and useless.
Mm-hmm. You're sitting in an armored seat anyway.
You're right. So. But you'd take the chest plate and you'd stick it in the window between the seat armor and the canopy, depending upon which way you were going to break.
Uh-huh.
Okay, gave you a little extra protection. You'd always be, a lot of times you'd tell the co-pilot, if it was going to be a hot one, to slide the chicken plate in under his shoulder straps.
Huh.
Okay? But take it out. One of the things we didn't like, if you went down and you had a hard landing, that damn thing had a tendency to ride up and hit you in the throat.
Mm.
But at one point they came out with a division-wide order that we would wear the chicken plates. So what we'd do is when we were taking off, we'd stick it under the shoulder straps, and as soon as we got airborne, we'd take it off.
Mm.
And then when we were coming back, we'd put it back on. And so they thought we'd take it off.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I didn't like it myself. So the Cobra crews, at least in our unit, very seldom did we ever wear the chicken plate.
Okay. Yeah, it's funny, the gentleman I'm going to interview this afternoon sent me a photo of himself standing in front of the Huey, and he's wearing a chicken plate, and he's also wearing a flak vest, you know, a regular issue flak vest over it.
Wow.
It was amusing.
Well,
he really wanted to be protected.
Well, the guy, you know, I'm, well, there's a chance, perfect example, Steve Modica,
okay,
Medevac 2, took two hits in the chest
mm-hmm.
and lived.
Right.
Okay, because he had his chicken plate on.
Right.
But Medevac crews, you'd be suicidal not to put that thing on.
Right.
And I think they wore them in the carrier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they actually wore them. But in the Cobras, we didn't.
Okay. Excellent. Hmm. Well, let's see. We've been going for about an hour and 10 minutes. You want to take a break? I don't know.
Sure. If you've got any other questions, you know, give me a call anytime.
Okay.
Once you start captioning photos or you decide what you're going to use, give me a call.
Okay.
I've got some more stuff coming from Mac Cookson that I'll send to you.
Okay.
Plus the three I'll pick up this afternoon.
Right.
There's two shots of Sound of Silence at a hover,
mm-hmm.
and then there's a shot of the crew chief sitting up in with the canopy open,
mm-hmm.
and it's got a very clear, large shot of the starboard side, so you'll get an idea of you know, what it looked like. And that'll be a pretty easy profile to do because the bird was freshly painted.
Oh, great.
Okay, so it's a uniform OD, brand spanking new looking, Sound of Silence in light blue with white trim, the Blue Max symbol on the pylon, and
mm-hmm.
just the red circle on the nose in the standard position.
Okay.
And 054 on the tail.
Excellent. Yeah, I've got about a dozen profiles set, but I had been holding one for that bird.
Yeah, have you had any luck with 4th of the 77th?
No, I haven't.
I'm having a tough time getting anything out of those guys myself.
Yeah.
I've sent emails off to two people. And I've gotten no response.
Hmm. Yeah, I've had some success with B Troop of 2nd of the 17th Cav, but that's about it.
Nothing from the 229th, huh?
No.
Nothing from the 1st of the 9th?
Nope, not yet.
I'll get Jimmy Sugar. I'll light a fire under him. He was with E Troop 1st of the 9th.
Okay, so
when they folded up the 229th and 227th,
uh-huh.
a lot of those guys were farmed out to different units,
okay.
and they used a cadre of the Cobra pilots from those units to form E Troop 1st of the 9th.
Okay.
So I'll get hold of him. They had some pretty interesting birds too. Some great markings on them.
Uh-huh.
Leprechaun, Raid had the Raid insect spray logo on the side of it.
Oh, really?
Very cool. I'm trying to think of some of the others. But, yeah, they had some pretty interesting nose art out of those units.
Okay.
I'll see if I can get Sugar, light him up, and get something from him. Let's see. Sugar and Fenwick for 229th.
Okay.
And first of the ninth. And we should be able to get you something for that, for those guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wonderful.
All right.
Very cool. All right, let me just officially end this. This will end the interview with Mr. Jim Moran on 28 March.